So I recorded a makeup lecture for that, which you should all get access to. And so that should be, that's going to follow after this lecture. Today we're going to continue talking about Kerr black holes. First, we're going to talk a little bit about ergospheres, and then we're going to go on to talking about geodesics on Kerr spacetimes. So first of all, let's talk about ergospheres. Let's see, is that a bit bigger? So ergospheres. If you recall, we defined TA as the killing vector associated with the fact that we have a stationary spacetime. So we can look at the character of TA at the black hole horizon. So if we evaluate this at R equals R plus, so in general, that's just going to be given by the metric component GTT in our Borelli coordinates, and at the horizon we get a squared sine squared theta over sigma, and that's actually going to be greater than or equal to zero, and when it's greater than zero, that means that this vector TA is actually space-like. So this means TA is space-like on the horizon, except at theta equals zero and theta equals pi, where it's null. So since we know that this vector here is going to be time-like at large radii, and then it's going to become space-like by the time we hit the horizon, we now want to figure out exactly where this transition happens from being time-like to space-like, in particular where it's null. So to determine that, we again just want to determine the point where this is equal to zero. That's going to happen where delta is equal to a squared sine squared theta. And if we recall the definition of delta, that gives us the following condition. Okay, so that actually defines the ergosphere. So we can kind of sketch what it looks like. So if we are looking at our black hole, and this is the direction of the spin, that's our black hole, this is R plus, then the ergo region kind of look like this. It'll meet the black hole at the two poles, and then at the equator here, it'll be RV2M. And sort of from the top-down view, so we have a black hole like this, looking down on the spin axis. So spinning that way, then we just get a circle. Sorry for the poor drawing, of radius 2m. So in the next lecture, actually, we'll show why this region is called the erg region. So ergo means work. So this is actually the region where you can tap into the black hole's rotational energy to do work. So we'll talk about that in the next lecture. Now I want to just want to note another property of this Urga region. So if we consider some time like for velocity UA, so just by and we'll just by the normalization condition, we know that UA contracted with itself should give minus one. So yes, sir, is a question?
Could you repeat what the diagram on the right is?
So this is just the top-down view of the Erg region. So it's just saying, if you look at the in the equator, it's just a circle of radius 2m. So this would be kind of like a head-on. So in this picture, this is the equator, and then this is a top-down view of the black hole where you see the equator.
Got it. Thanks.
Good. Any other questions? All right. So if we just expand this out, and components. We get the following. So those are, and then the one cross term we have is this the T phi component. So the point to make is that if we're, so these three components here, the sort of just the spatial, purely spatial parts, those are always going to be positive. And then if we're within the Erg region, this GTT, just by definition, is also going to be positive. So that means basically all these terms right here are going to be positive. But since they all, since the whole right side hand side of the equation has to add up to negative one, that actually means that this component here has to be negative. Need a new page here. Oops. So if we go to a new page, since GT phi is less than zero, and recall that UT is just by definition DT D tau, so that had better be greater than zero for sort of moving towards the future. This means that U phi, which is just the derivative of the phi direction with respect to proper time, that had actually be must be greater than zero so that we can get a negative term here. And so what this means physically is that to have a time-like observer in the Erga region, it actually has to have a positive U phi component. You know, we can't just have this, in particular, you can't just have U phi equals zero. So it kind of has to rotate with the black hole. So that's kind of another property of the Erg region. But you should be a little bit careful because this fact that it kind of has to rotate is a somewhat coordinate dependent statement. So you'll see kind of work through an example of that in the first problem set where you consider the Erg region and some different coordinates. So we can consider an observer with a four velocity that's sort of instantaneously sitting at a fixed radius. So what I mean by that is the fork velocity is going to just have a time component. That's our claim vector t hat, and it's going to rotate with some velocity omega. And alpha is just some normalization constant, which we can derive from the usual normalization condition. So as I just argued, you can't just set phi equal to, or sorry, you can't just set omega equal to zero in the ergo region. So instead, let's try to construct what's called a zero angular momentum observer. That's also sometimes abbreviated as a ZAMO. So by zero angular momentum, I mean that it measured the angular momentum using our axisymmetric Killing vector, that we should get zero. So if we work to what that means, it's going to be that g phi gt plus g phi phi omega should be equal to zero. Or just rewriting that, so a rotational velocity, which is just this, basically the coordinate velocity in the azimuth direction is going to be given by this ratio of minus gt phi over g phi phi, where these are just the Bohr-Lindquist metric coefficients. So we can see what a value omega takes approaching the horizon for a zero angular momentum observer. And what we get is that going to R plus, omega actually equals the dimensionless spin A over 2R plus. So we can interpret this as the horizon frequency of the black hole, omega H. And so we can also note that this chi A, which I wrote down here, is actually a Killing vector, right? Because it's just a linear combination of these two Killing vectors. Let me say this another way. So if I fix omega to be omega H, then this is a Killing vector. Because it's just a linear combination of two Killing vectors. And it actually becomes null at the black hole horizon. One other way to say that is that the event horizon is actually a Killing horizon with this particular Killing vector, chi A. So we can also take a look at what values omega H takes for different spins and a couple different limits. So the first one to consider is the low spin limit. So dimensionless spin much less than one. So in that case, R plus is close to two. Some small correction. And omega H is approximately a bar over 4m. So that's what you get for a slowly rotating black hole. And then, of course, the other limit to consider is where it is close to extremal limit. And in that case, the horizon radius is approaching just m, and the rotational, the horizon frequency is approaching just 1 over 2m. So any questions about that?
I have a question. Before, there was an alpha parameter.
Yeah, so sorry.
what is
These are actually slightly different vectors. So here I'm just considering a ZAMO. And so A, so then this would correspond to a four velocity. And then so alpha you just get by requiring this actually be a four velocity. So you get this normalization constant. This is just a different killing vector. And so here I'm not trying to normalize it so that it has a particular, yeah, so that it corresponds to a four velocity. So it's just a killing vector. And so here I am not letting omega be something free. I'm letting it be equal to omega h. And so this vector, in fact, becomes null at the black hole horizon. But basically approaching the ZAMO approaching the horizon will kind of point in the same direction as this killing vector.
So what exact? This is a killing vector? Means even when there was no omega h, it was just ta plus omega phi a. So this is a killing vector, but it's what is special about this combination?
So this one is a killing vector. Here I haven't fixed omega. So this is the ZAMO. Yeah.
Yeah, but what I'm asking is the killing vector could be some alpha TA plus beta. Why do we have this particular form? And what is special about why the TA plus omega phi A combination?
So this is the one that actually becomes this particular killing vector is special because it becomes null at the black hole horizon. So in some sense, technically, the black hole is the killing horizon of this killing vector, and not the individual axially symmetric one or stationary one.
Thanks.
Yeah, good questions. Anything else? Okay, so if not, we're going to switch gears slightly, and now we're going to begin talking about geodesic sun curve.
Could you leave the previous? Yeah.
All right, so now geodesics are sort of the trajectories that small test bodies will take when orbiting around a black hole, and so we're going to go through some derivations of the various today we're mainly focus on bound orbits around curved spacetimes, but sort of at the end of the lecture I want to sort of convince you that they're not just sort of a mathematical artifact, but looking at the properties of geodesics can actually give you some intuition about the non-test body case. So as a reminder, for time-like geodesics, we have the geodesic equation. And that's given by this in sort of covariant form. And then of course, remember UA is just the coordinate position of the geodesic, its derivative with respect to proper time. If we had a null geodesic instead, then we have to use some affine parameter instead of tau. But here we're going to mainly focus on time-like geodesics. So in a general setting, this geodesic equation would give us a second order equation. So if we kind of write out components, we get the following. with our Postoffel symbols. It turns out in Kerr spacetime, because of the symmetries, we're actually kind of in better shape, because we can use the fact that we have these conserved quantities given by Killing vectors that are actually constant along geodesics. So because of that, we don't actually have to solve this second order ODE. So the constants we have, we have the energy, or normalized energy, we get by contracting the pore velocity with our Killing vector associated with stationarity. And I've added a minus sign here. So be positive. So that's just this component. Or written on in terms of the upper indices. Oops. That's just this. And if we plug in our Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, okay. So that's one constant. And then of course we have the other Killing vector associated with axis symmetry, which will give us angular momentum. So simple form with lower indices, with upper indices. We have these two components. And then using Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. And then there's this another term. Okay, so these are, so now we have the energy here and a angular momentum of our geodesic. And then the tilde is here just because it's divided by the sort of mass of the test body. So we should note that a bound orbit is going to always have that the normalized energy is less than one, because it's sort of a particle at r equals infinity with a zero velocity. We just have e tilde equal to one. So there's actually one more conserved quantity, as we kind of briefly discussed in last class. And that's because there's this, in addition to these Killing vectors, there's a Killing tensor. And so the sort of third conserved quantity is called the Carter constants, right? And so you get that just by taking that the Killing tensor that I wrote down in the previous lecture and then subtracting it. Sorry, contracting it with the pore velocity twice. And so this one actually allows you to integrate non-equatorial geodesics in Kerr, which in general won't actually lie within a plane. So they can get quite complicated. But so in this lecture, we're actually just going to focus on equatorial geodesics, in which case the fact that this Carter constant is conserved along geodesics basically just tells you, you know, if you start in the equatorial plane with zero velocity out of the equator, then you'll stay in the equatorial plane forever. So in that sense, we're not going to have to worry about the Carter constant. So we're going to be in the equator, and we're going to set the theta velocity to zero. All right, any questions so far? Okay, so we kind of have one more thing that's conserved, and that's just the normalization condition. So as our four velocity changes along the geodesic, we should always have that its norm is equal to minus one. So if we write that out using our conserved constants, we get this. Oops. And where this guy is just given by lowering the one with the upper indices, and it's supposed to be like this dr d tau. This one should be upper indices too. These the metric with upper indices, of course, can just be found by taking the metric with lower indices and doing the usual matrix inversion. Just restricting again to the equator, these ones with upper indices, let's write them down explicitly. That's GT, GRR. Simpler is delta over r squared, and g phi phi delta minus a squared over delta times r squared, and these are off diagonal 1, 2. All right, so those are just the inverse metric components in the equator. So now we're going to rewrite this normalization condition. Let's call it star. So plugging in all these metric coefficients, star becomes the following. All right. So, we can do a little bit of work on this if we sort of move the first term on the left-hand side to the right-hand side, multiply through by delta r squared, then collect all of the powers of r, finally end up with something like the following. That's our square term, and we have a linear term R. All right, so we're going to call this whole thing on the left, on the right hand side. Sorry, so part of our effective potential, and it's a function of E tilde, J tilde, and R. We can notice that this delta squared goes like R squared, R to the fourth power. As dr d tau goes to zero, so that means that the dr d tau goes to zero as R goes to infinity. If you have delta E equals to 1. The important thing to note is that this potential V actually gives us the turning points. So the zeros of V will give us our turning points. That's where dr t tau equals to 0. All right, so any questions so far? So I just sort of skipped a little bit of the algebra to go from here to here, but should be pretty straightforward. Okay, so for bound orbits with E tilde less than 1, if we let R go to infinity, then the first term dominates, and the VR just goes to infinity, so that means that you can't escape all the way to infinity. Which is what you expect for a bound orbit has to turn around at some finite radius. We can consider now what happens on the horizon. So that's for R equals R plus. If we just take this, let's call this equation here double star. So if we take double star and evaluate for R equals R plus, which we'll call means that delta equals 0, then after a little bit of algebra, we can actually write it as something that's always going to be less than or equal to 0. And we can also note that you know, VR, it has like, or if we divide VR by R, then we're just going to have a cubic. So it's going to either have one or three zeros. So we can use these two facts to sort of sketch the possible forms for V of R. So one option, so we have something like this. Where we have, let's say, this is R plus here. So we have to start negative. This is the case where we have three zeros, or it could be in the other case. We just have 1, 0. So to have bound stable orbits, we actually want to choose values of E tilde and J tilde where in the first case, this one. So in this case, you know, you can sit here and then you'd orbit back and forth stably. You know, if you were on the other side here, then moving this way, there's no turning point, so you just hold onto the black hole. And if you're, you know, up here, we just keep falling all the way down until you go into the black hole. The sort of marginal, there's also, of course, like the marginal case between case one and case two. And that's going to occur where yeah, the following. That's where we have some radius where V and its derivative both vanish. And we want this to happen for some radius that's outside the black hole horizon. So this value RC actually corresponds to a circular orbit because it's the point where both the first and second derivatives of R with respect to time vanish. So we're you know, basically at zero velocity and acceleration at that radius in the radial direction. So we can use the two equations we have to sort of solve for E tilde to basically, so we have these two equations here. And then we have two unknowns, right? E tilde and J tilde. So we can plug through the math. It's straightforward, but a little bit messy. But we can figure out then what the energy and angular momentum are of circular orbits corresponds to.
Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah.
Can you just back up a little bit? Why we're choosing diagram, first diagram over the second one again, please?
Yeah, so I said, well, we're actually choosing sort of the marginal case between the two for circular orbits, but I was just saying that if you want a stable but non-circular orbit, then that would be one where you kind of sit here, right? And so you would go back and forth between these two turning points, right? But if you're in the second case here, that would be one where you would just fall into the black hole.
So in the points wherever V intersects, R would be the points of circular orbits, because at that point, dr by theta is zero, right?
So the points where V equals zero, those are the turning points. We're now looking for circular orbits where basically both V and its first derivative vanish. And so that's kind of the marginal case in between these two.
Also, in means the expression for V that we had was initially R power 4, right? It was quartic. And then,
yeah.
So we took one R common, and then it becomes R into something cubic.
Yeah, so it's going to have 1, 0, just that R equals 0. But you notice there's no constant term, right? So I can just kind of factor that one out.
And yeah, then the plot has to turn again somewhere to go to 0 at R is equal to 0, right? Is the plot
Sorry, right. This is basically like V over R.
Okay. Oh, I see. I see. Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, so I was kind of cutting, or you can say another way, I was cutting off at R equals R plus.
Okay.
Because we're not really considering what happens inside the black hole.
Yeah, got it.
Okay, thanks for the questions. Any other ones? Okay, so now what happens if we solve for E tilde and J tilde that satisfy these two equations? So we can get these circular orbits. So we get that the energy is given by the following. And there's a square root over the whole denominator. And then get something similar looking for the normalizing momentum. And then for the denominator, we actually have the same expression. All right. And so you should note here that we're choosing J tilde to be greater than 0, but then letting the spin of the black hole be either positive or negative. And of course, there's sort of a redundancy here where if we, you know, flip the sign of the spin and then also flip the angular momentum of the test particle, we should get the same thing. So those expressions are a little bit involved. So let's look at a couple different limits. So one is to consider the large R limit, in which case our energy is approximately just this. And our angular momentum is given by this. And so that's actually just the expressions we expect from Newtonian physics. And of course, there's the extra one here just for the rest mass. And then there's the gravitational potential binding energy. So you can also note that the denominator here blows up. And so we have the same denominator for EC and GC. So it blows up at some particular value where that denominator goes to 0. So basically, if we solve for this value of the radius where it goes to zero, this will actually give you the minimum radius where you can have a circular orbit. So we can look at this in a few limits. So zero spin. We can have circular orbits all the way up to 3m. For extremal spin, it's aligned with our orbital angular momentum. We can actually go all the way up to m. And then for a spin in the opposite direction, you can only go up to 4m. So you can sort of angular momentum that's aligned allows you to orbit closer to the black hole, and one that's anti-aligned farther away. So in general, there's can just write down this expression, but in general, for any spin, you get something like this. So these minimum values of E tilde and J tilde, so as you approach them, you're actually orbiting faster and faster. And the limiting values actually corresponds to orbiting basically at the speed of light or a null geodesic. So these are as you may actually call, the photon orbit of a curve of a non-spinning black hole is at 3m. So this minimum circular orbit corresponds to that photon orbit. However, just because they're circular orbits doesn't actually mean that they're stable. For these values, as you approach them, actually turns out that they're unstable in the sense that if you give a small nudge to a particle on one of these orbits, it will either fall into the black hole or fly away. To kind of return to our potential picture. If we have the potential, something like this, this point here would correspond to a stable circular orbit. Whereas a case like this, here we have the V and its first derivative are zero, but that would actually correspond to an unstable circular orbit. So the sort of marginal case in between these two would be, sorry, was the question?
Would this again be V over R, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, or I mean, I think it's, or we can just, I think we can just consider this to be R plus, and then it does have to turn around again there, but yeah, either way. So then the marginal case is like this, where that's sort of a tangent. Basically, we want to figure out where we go from having stable to unstable orbits. And there's a couple ways you could do that. One, you could just use the fact that its first and second derivatives of the function R have to be zero. Or another way to do it is to basically look at where this energy of a circular orbit is a function of its radius is equal to zero. And so this minimum value where you can have stable orbits is usually referred to as the ISCO, for innermost stable circular orbit. So solving exactly where this happens requires some messy algebra that I'm going to skip. You know, basically you would take this expression for dc, you square it, take its derivative, set it to zero, and get some fraction you have to set to zero, and then sort of when all the dust clears on that, you end up with the following.
Excuse me.
Yep.
V plus like the positive upper plane of the diagram doesn't make any sense, right? Because it would be equal to minus U R squared, and it would be negative, right? So the upper plane is negative.
Say that again, please.
We're defining the V in a way that it was minus delta squared U R squared, right? So the upper plane of V, which is V positive, basically means that U R squared would be negative, right?
You're saying
yeah, like right here.
Sorry. Oh yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. You're right. I think that should not be there.
Even in this case, you know, delta will be positive for outside horizon cases, right? Outside the horizon, still the LHS is positive.
That's correct. Yeah, I think maybe that is there.
Usually potential when we define is like some second derivative in R is equal to potential, something trying to devise a Schrodinger like equation or something.
Yeah, but it's like energy. If you have the kinetic term as U R squared and you have the potential energy, this is the effective potential defined this way, not in the like.
So what you're saying is correct. I think what you're saying is correct, that basically we need to live in the places where this is negative, right? So you can't have orbits here, but you can have orbits here, right?
If I have like a photon coming from infinity to this plane, it would be like a trajectory coming from infinity, and it will get back, which basically, yeah. I think that it will go to the black hole, and if you expand the space time maximally, it would basically mean that it will get out from a white hole or something, I guess, right?
Yeah. So sorry. What you're saying is correct, that basically we can only have valid orbits for the places where V is zero or negative. So for example, if our potential looks like this, then you couldn't have orbits here. You can have an orbit here that would, you know, start here, it would go toward to V equals zero, and then would turn around and come back here. Or you could have an orbit that starts here, and then it would go just into the black hole. For a diagram that looks like this, you could start at this point and then fall into the black hole. So maybe it's confusing that I said that you would start there because you have to start here. And then, yeah, for these diagrams here, we're just actually imagining that you're sitting at this point where V equals zero. And so this would correspond to a stable point because, like you said, you can't go to positive V either way. But for this case here, this would actually be unstable because a little nudge and you can actually fall into the black hole or we can go up to a larger radii.
Yeah, but I want to see what would happen in real world. You know, in real world, everything, for instance, the photon comes from infinity, and I want to see if trajectory is coming from infinity, what they look like. Because, you know, imagine that you're starting in a horizontal line.
So by construction here, we're just considering the bound orbits, right? So that's why it blows up at infinity, right? In the next class, we'll talk about marginally bound orbits. So those are the ones that can go to infinity. So that's E tilde equals to one. You're right that, you know, if you are on one of these bound orbits, right, then you had to have at some point lost some energy. If you had come in from infinity, you had to have lost some energy to be on a bound orbit. Right. But that does happen, right? So for example, you lose energy to gravitational waves or something like that. So yeah. Thanks for clarifying that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. So
how a photon can lose energy here? I can get it for different objects coming from infinity to the black hole. But if I have a photon trajectory coming from infinity, I wanna. But I guess as you mentioned, it will, because you know we just schematically drew the diagram for B. Probably if we drew it completely, it would be different for trajectories from infinity, right?
Yeah. So here we're focusing on time-like geodesics and in particular bound ones. But if we do the diagram for null trajectories, again, you can have bound or unbound orbits. So you can imagine, if you have something that emits a photon in the vicinity of the black hole, then it could be on a bound orbit around the black hole. And there's this light ring, for example, would be a bound circular orbit. So that's kind of a special property of black holes that the photons can actually have bound orbits. But there'd be another set of geodesics which you could solve for, which would correspond to unbound ones that come in from infinity.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're talking about the ISCO and what happens if you solve this equation. Get the following. So this is actually a So this is actually going to be a quartic function in the square root of RSQ. So I'm just going to write down a couple, that's something you could solve in principle. I'm just going to write down a couple specific cases. So for a zero spin, this simplifies a lot. So you just get that the innermost staple circular orbit is at 6m. For extremal spin, you can check that the solution is just m. And for counter rotating spin, you can check that the ISCO actually moves out. So it's greater than the one for non-spinning case, it's at 9m. And there's some general formula for the ISCO, but I'm not gonna write that down. So for sort of the intermediate case, in between the minimum circular orbit and the ISCO, you get these unstable circular orbits. And so in the first two tutorials, you actually look at constructing these geodesics and looking at what happens when you perturb these unstable circular orbits. And you actually get this very interesting so-called zoom whirl behavior, where you have orbits that circle around the black hole several times and then go out to infinity or fall into the black hole. And so you get to kind of explore that for yourself. I just want to mention that, here we kind of glossed over the exact derivation of the ISCO, because the details are a little bit messy, but I do think that these kind of specific numbers for the behavior of the ISCO and how it changes with spin are actually kind of good to have in your back of your head for understanding what happens when you have black holes orbiting each other. For example, you can imagine you have a black hole, and you have another object orbiting around it, be another black hole or a neutron star or something. So it's going on a quasi, it's orbiting sort of very close to a circular orbit, and it's slowly losing energy to gravitational waves. So this orbit's radius is slowly changing and getting smaller and smaller. And then at some point, it's going to transition from the so-called quasi-circular in spiral to a plunge, where it's going to very rapidly fall into the black hole. And can anybody guess at what radius approximately we should expect this transition from this quasi-circular in spiral to the plunge?
The ISCO,
yes. And so if, if we compare a black hole that has a large spin, aligned with this orbital angular momentum compared to one that has no spin, do you expect the plunge to happen sooner or later in the orbit?
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, so say you have a black hole with large spin that's aligned with the orbital angular momentum of this inspiraling particle, then do you expect the plunge to happen sooner or later in the orbit compared to the non-spinning case?
Later.
Yep, that's right. So this should kind of be exact for like an extreme mass ratio. For example, we think that sometimes around supermassive black holes that are millions or even billions of times the mass of our sun. There are compact objects that are a few solar masses, but actually is a pretty good approximation even for sort of equal mass binaries. So for example, if you think of the gravitational wave signal that you see from inspiring black holes and sort of a spectrogram, so its frequency is a function of time. So you might have one case that would correspond to basically the two objects not having any intrinsic spin, and so you get some signal where the frequency is increasing as you inspire faster and faster, and then you have the plunge. And then if you sort of compare that to the case where the black holes have spin that's aligned with the Erbilgo momentum, then you actually would see the plunge happen later and at higher frequencies. And that kind of explains the fact that if you ever look at any of these LIGO observations, they're actually most sensitive to the components of the black hole spins that are in the direction of the orbital angular momentum. That's sometimes called chi effective. So the gravitational wave signal gives you a good measurement of that one quantity, and the components of the black hole spins that are sort of orthogonal to the orbital angular momentum are not that well constrained by the gravitational wave signal. And maybe one quick final example before leaving the lecture. So you can also consider like black hole accretion disks. You know, if you have some black hole that's accreting material and letting off X-rays or something like that. And so usually these accretion disk solutions, so if we're kind of looking at the black hole head on, then the accretion disks will look something like this. Or maybe even bigger. And then you'll have maybe some very thin stream of material falling into here in the black hole. But basically this, this distance here between the edge of the accretion disk and the black hole is just given by the ISCO. So when people try to measure black hole spins, a lot of times what they're doing is trying to sort of fit the profile for the accretion disk given some electromagnetic observations, and then use that as a measure of the black hole's ISCO, and then from that back out what the black hole spin is. So I think I'm kind of over time, but let me just end here and ask if there are any other questions. Okay, so if there are no other questions, I guess I will see everyone on Tuesday.